I know I'm Denenberg, and I represent the personal representative of the estate. And this matter is here on statute 302424, which is a procedure to remove the personal representative. It somehow got converted into an action for damages, and I don't know how that happened, but let me give you a little background. Elder Graham, the deceased, was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer in June of 2013. And she was given a short life expectancy, maybe 3 to 6 years. Nobody, of course, knew. And she used that time to design her estate. Now, Greg Graham, the personal representative, was almost like a child to her. He was her closest relative in Omaha. She designated him as personal representative on her will. She designated him as her power of attorney to help her settle her estate. He was the principal beneficiary of her assets, and he inherited something over $500,000. And he was the one that she had the trust and confidence in to carry out her plan. Now, her estate consisted of a house that she lived in, her investments, which she gave to Greg Graham, some personal property that she accumulated. There wasn't a lot. She was a very frugal woman. And she even put his name on her checking account. Now, this was happening. She was giving away her property. She was trying to dispose of her estate. Friends and relatives would visit, and she would, some would get some jewelry, some would get other items. But anyway, that went on in June, July, and August. September 5th, she died.
September 5th?
And she was buried, and I filed the probate of the estate.
September of 2013? Was it September of 2013?
Yes, September 2013. She lived maybe three plus months. I filed her estate, and Greg Graham was appointed the personal representative. And the last day for claims in the estate was November 27th. Now, when I consult, I tell the personal representative not to start distributing an estate until after claims day, because who knows what kind of claims will be filed or what problems will come up. But anyway, for the next 3 months, or after claims day, Greg Graham did distribute the property. And he distributed some of the CDs he actually passed out before the end of claims day. But at the end of claims day, he finished the passing out some the personal property. He deeded the house to Mr. Gallagher. Merle Gallagher was that person. He concluded passing out all the personal items, and by February 16th, 3 months after the last claims day, everything was passed out. He had possession of nothing. But earlier on January 15th, the Merle Gallagher filed a motion to remove the PR because at that time, that was only 6 weeks after the last day for claims, some of the people hadn't received their personal property, and he claimed that for that reason he wanted a new PR. And that was still pending on April, that was still pending when after April 16th, when all the property was distributed, not April, July, or September. Well, that was still pending when, after all the property had been distributed. And it was my impression that that property would be dismissed or be held inconsequential, but he wanted to go ahead with his motion to, I don't know what a new personal representative actually would do. All the property had been distributed. I think there was some tax matters that may have needed winding up, but that was really a little consequence. So we had a trial.
What interest in the state would Mr. Gallagher have after he was deeded the residence?
Judge, my hearing's not very good.
What interest would Mr. Gallagher have in the estate after the residence had been deeded to him?
What interest did he have in the estate?
After he received the house. Did he have anything left?
Well, no. He was also designated to get some of the personal property, whatever was left of her jewelry. And after he was deeded the house, he receded for receiving tools and about 25 items that was passed out to him, but that was after they filed the motion that he didn't get it fast enough or something. So we went ahead with the trial. Now the first witness was a lady by the name of Elaine Cisneros, and she testified that she received all of the property that she was supposed to receive. But then she started to testify about something that happened months earlier when Hilda Graham was alive. And at that time, Hilda Graham she was moving CDs around to persons that she thought she wanted to have. And she moved a CD that was originally intended to go to Elaine Cisneros, but she called for power of attorney, and Cisneros had got another $70,000 CD, and she didn't obviously want her to have this. She called her power of attorney.
Well, how do we know what she told her power of attorney?
I beg your pardon?
How do we know what she told her attorney in fact? When she's dead and he didn't testify.
He testified that she told him to take the power of attorney, cash it.
I thought your client wasn't available for the hearing.
I beg your pardon, Judge.
I thought your client wasn't available for the hearing.
No, he wasn't. I tried to get him available.
Yeah, so how did the testimony come in about...
This was from his deposition, Judge.
Okay.
Which is part of the record.
Okay.
He said she called me. She said she handed me this power of attorney. She was still controlling everything. She said, cash this and put the money in my account. The same day, and we have the receipts and everything, he took it, he cashed it, he put the money in her account, and he came back to her and said, here's the receipt, the money went into your account. She took out her check register in her own handwriting. She wrote it in the check register. Now they claim that that's her money because he didn't have he didn't have authority to do that. But she ratified it. And the definition of a ratification is to make a transaction legal that might otherwise he not have authority. But And there's other reasons. The new Uniform Power of Attorney Act allows him to do that. And Section 30-40, 14-4, says that even though he has some benefit, or even though he was on the account as another beneficiary, that doesn't kill the transaction. But incidentally, you gentlemen will decide that because that case is on appeal to this court. But that had nothing to do with his acting as a personal representative in an estate. That didn't say that he wasn't a fit person to be a personal representative. The defense that says that, well, that shows he was dishonest. It doesn't show he was dishonest. If anything's dishonest, it's bringing that case into this case, which has nothing to do with his duties at a PR. Well, I'm going to run out of time. Anyway, and the other witnesses testified that they didn't get all of their property. The only other one, she had a peanut collection of a bunch of little peanut characters, and she claimed she receipted for 160 of them, but she said there were some missing. And that was pretty much the testimony. And the judge at that time started entering judgments for witnesses. Linda Clark was just a witness in this case, and the judge entered a judgment for her for some peanut collection that she lost. And I want to save whatever little time I have maybe for a final comment.
I think you're out of time, Mr. Denenberg.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Hassenjaeger, good morning.
Good morning, Your Honor. Good morning. Your Honor, by the way, I have co-counsel with me here this morning, too, Howard Kyman, and he's co-counsel with me on this case. Your Honor, I think the first thing we should probably talk about is whether or not this court should review the order of Judge Lowe. I had made a motion for summary disposition some time ago with respect to whether or not Mr. Denenberg's appeal of this matter was timely. And the reason why I say it's not timely is because he had filed a motion for a new trial back on April 14 of 2013, which was just about 3 days after Judge Lowe had entered his order of April 11.
So the motion was filed within 10 days of the entry of the order?
The motion was filed timely, that's correct.
But it wasn't scheduled for hearing.
He did not schedule for hearing until August 6 or 8, 2013.
But prior to that time, it was not stricken by the court as for failure to comply with any scheduling rules. There was no action taken until after the hearing, and it was disposed on the merits, correct?
Well,
disposed, I guess, for being out of time. That was the...
If that's what Judge Lowe was really thinking about at the time, because it was confusing as to how the motion for new trial and the notice of hearing were transmitted from Mr. Denenberg's office to the court, identified fax originally. On April 11, he only sent in a notice of new trial, a motion for new trial, also a motion for continuance. At that time, he filed a notice of hearing for the continuance, which was actually heard in June of 2013. The motion for new trial just sat there.
Is there any statute that requires a notice of hearing to accompany a motion for new trial?
The court rules do, Your Honor.
I didn't ask about court rules. I asked about a statute.
No, I don't know the statute that says that.
Okay. Now, you're talking about a local rule of the county court or county court rules?
Of the district courts. The county court doesn't have a rule as such, but the rules, as I understand them, Your Honor, starting from the Constitution, the rules of the district court will apply to the county court in such matters. And that the rule of the district court that I'm alluding to simply says that a moving party at the time of filing his motion for new trial, or filing his motion, has a duty to also go ahead and arrange for a hearing, to have a hearing set by contacting the judge or the judge's staff.
Was there another motion pending also with regard to this case to reopen the hearing?
There was a motion for a continuance, and that was specifically for the reason that Mr. Denenberg claimed that his client was ill that morning, the morning of the hearing of April 1st.
Was that heard, the motion for continuance?
The motion for continuance was heard.
And were you all on notice of it?
The motion for continuance was accompanied by a notice of hearing back in April, but the motion for new trial was never accompanied by a hearing notice until August.
Were you aware of the motion for the continuance?
Yes.
Did you appear for the motion for a continuance?
Yes, I did. And at that time, Judge Lowe said, well, the question then was whether or not it should be reopened because of the fact that the Mr. Graham was at the emergency room that morning complaining of chest pains. And evidence was presented to the court. It's in the brief. It's in the transcript, where Judge Lowe looked at the hospital records and found that Mr. Graham was actually given a clean bill of health by 8 o'clock in the morning.
So
he
I'm,
had gastrointestinal problems.
You all have been doing this for a couple of years. I'm trying to catch up here.
Yeah.
If you have a motion for a new trial, and it's accompanied by a notice of hearing to continue such motion, is that right?
Yes.
It should be. And in your view, it should be, and so forth. Would it also be logical to notice up the hearing on the substantive motion for a new trial, or would you not want to dispose of the continuance of it prior to noticing up the hearing of the actual new trial motion?
You mean me as a non-moving
party?
Well,
the logic of it. And the rules, yeah.
The rules are rules. And the rule says the moving party shall go ahead and obtain a hearing date at the same time he files his motion for a new trial. And
all
he
right.
didn't do it.
So he didn't do that, but the motion was never stricken, and it was eventually ruled upon.
Eventually ruled upon, yes. Yes.
And the hearing on it was continued, and you all were aware of the continuance. The motion for a new trial was continued.
Well, the motion for new trial was actually set down for a hearing in August.
Okay.
And I did not attend that one. I don't recall receiving a notice that we're going to have a hearing on that date. It was August something. But as it turned out, Judge Lowe ruled in my favor anyway, so no harm, no error.
Is the order that was entered on the motion for new trial, is that dated August 12th, 2014?
Yes, Your Honor. And Judge Lowe simply ruled that was out of time. And
well, what does that mean?
Well, I think the confusing part there was what Judge Lowe had before him was what Mr. Denenberg had done in August. He went ahead and requested a hearing time
for
his motion for new trial.
Yeah.
And at the time he did that, he attached in a fax a copy of the motion for new trial. That was actually already filed with the court back in April.
And you would concede that motion was timely filed?
Well, the motion was timely filed, yes, in April.
And there also was a motion pending for reopening of the hearing. You said the record that it was a motion for continuance, but it's titled Motion to Reopen the Hearing, and wasn't that not ruled on until July 15th?
That's correct.
So why would you want to have your motion for new trial ruled on before the court had ruled on a motion to reopen the hearing?
Well, he could have set them both down at the same time, and that's probably what should have happened.
Okay. Then with regard to the order, denies a request for a hearing on the motion for a new trial in that it is filed out of time. What does that do with the motion for a new trial? Do you consider that a denial of the motion for a new trial?
I think that Judge Lowe was saying that the motion for a new trial was filed out of time.
Well, and if it were filed timely, it wouldn't be filed out of time, would it?
Well, that's correct. But I'm saying it is filed out of time if it is not accompanied by a notice of hearing. I think the court rule simply says the moving party has the duty to file its motion and also obtain a hearing at the same time. That's what the rule says, and that's what was not done. 116 days had gone by. There's a reason for filing a motion for new trial
within
10 days after the order. And that's to keep these things moving. It's not 30 days, it's 10 days.
So there was a hearing by Judge Lowe, and what came out of that order?
The
PR
order,
was removed.
Oh, well, the order of April 11 removed the PR, awarded damages.
But it came on for just a hearing to remove the PR, was it not?
Yes.
So how did it morph into an action for damages?
Well, the application to have her removed set forth the wrongs that we claimed that Mr. Graham had committed.
But the application didn't request that type of relief, did it?
The application did not pray for that relief. But Judge Lowe just simply said, I've heard of the evidence, I've heard the damages.
Wouldn't the appellant be surprised if he was going into court just to hear whether the PR was going to be removed, and then it turns into a surcharge hearing?
Your Honor, I believe the case law says that if the allegations in the application are sufficient to more or less warn the other party that damages may be an issue here, then he knows.
But the other party, first of all, had a hearing in the emergency room, or went to the emergency room, wasn't there for the hearing, then asked the court to reopen the hearing. The court refused to do that or even allow him to take any evidence, and then just entered its order finding that there were certain damages owed to certain beneficiaries of the estate without any testimony from the PR.
Well, that's correct.
Could the PR have possibly offered explanations why this property wasn't received by the beneficiaries?
Well, Your Honor, we did include in the transcript a deposition of Mr. Graham that was taken back on March 7, about 3 weeks before the hearing. And at that time, we asked him questions. Why did you remove all this property from Hilda's house? Mr. Gallagher was...
You can finish your thought if you care.
Okay. Mr. Gallagher was the residuary beneficiary of her will, which meant he received probably 99% of the property in the house. The jewelry was taken away. Three jewelry boxes were removed from the house by Mr. Graham that we claim, and then only one jewelry box was brought back. We found that there was like $6,000 or $7,000 worth of jewelry that was not returned to Mr. Gallagher, who should have received that jewelry under the residuary clause.
But Mr. Gallagher had no opportunity after the court's determination of damages or during that hearing to explain where the property went or whether it was ever in his possession or anything else. He didn't have a chance to offer any of that testimony.
Mr. Graham did not have a chance.
I mean, Mr. Graham, yes.
Well, Mr. Graham, in his deposition, we do discuss that. And he admits that her jewelry was probably worth more than $1,000, which is what he showed on his inventory that he filed with the probate court prior to the hearing. I mean, he admitted that, okay, the $1,000 of miscellaneous charges.
Did he admit that he took it or kept it or sold it?
He said in his deposition he brought back what he took. However, we have other reliable witnesses. Hilda's good friend, Elaine, who was over there at her house most of the time with her before she died. Her cousin, Linda, who knew her jewelry. They were friends for 40 or 50 years.
Were there other people in and out of the place while she was ill and incapacitated?
Hospice workers.
Wouldn't that be a potential that somebody might like that jewelry as well?
Your Honor, my understanding, and this is not all on the record, but the hospice workers were pretty much there only for maybe an hour a day while there was someone else there, a friend, Mr. Gallagher, or Mr. Graham. I think Judge Lowe found that there was a fox in the hen house, and that fox was Mr. Graham. I think that's what the evidence shows, not just in the hearing that we had on April 1st, but also in the deposition that was taken of Mr. Gallagher back on March 7, 2013.
Thank you very much. We have no time for rebuttal, so we will go on to the next. You have no time for rebuttal, Mr. Denenberg. We will go on to the next case of the day, which is Binder versus Binder. You certainly may retrieve your materials. Thank you.